Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll discuss sometimes forgotten but still dangerous sexually transmitted diseases.
Nationally, we are starting to see the numbers nearly double to triple in terms of syphilis rates across the country.
Then, we'll look at the unmet promises of primary health care reform.
The whole overall goal of this was to get access for everybody for good health care in America, and also to cut down on the wasteful spending. We know that we spend a lot more for medicine in this country, and in spite of that, we don't have as good health care indices.
And a new way to get a buzz comes with some deadly risks.
I can get a 100-gram bag for about $5 to $10 at the moment.
Wow.
And that bag is equivalent to about 560 medium-sized Dunkin' Donuts coffees.
That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, powdered caffeine is now available on the internet. What dangers does it pose? Plus, the Affordable Care Act's impact on primary care medicine. What are the unmet promises? But first, with syphilis on the rise in this country, what do you need to know to be safe from this and other sexually transmitted diseases? Sexually transmitted diseases, also known as STDs, continue to be a public health concern, with the CDC estimating that nearly 20 million new cases occur each year. And most experts agree that controlling their spread depends a great deal on education. Well, here with more on these diseases and what you need to know is Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and the director of Upstate's Midwifery and Gynecology. Welcome, Heather. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So STDs, or sexually transmitted diseases, are still considered quite a health hazard, and some are on the rise. I've been reading that syphilis was eliminated in the U.S. almost a decade ago, but currently we've seen an upsurge in it. It's actually on the rise. Tell us about that.
That's correct, Linda. Nationally, we are starting to see the numbers nearly double to triple in terms of syphilis rates across the country.
Yeah, and is it hitting a particular population at this point?
At this point, we are finding that more and more men who are either bisexual, homosexual, or men having sex with men, who are heterosexual but for other reasons having sex with men, there's an increase in this population of syphilis.
So those are the ones who are most strongly affected at this point. That's where we see the rise occurring.
That is correct. However, there is a carry-off that those men who are heterosexual, who are having sex with men for whatever particular reasons, are passing it on to women unknowingly.
So, in fact, syphilis is rising in both men and women.
Men and women, but more so in this particular population of men having sex with men.
Tell us about Onondaga County, though. It sounds like we are also having a rise here, I mean, reflecting what's going on in the nation. What's going on right here in Onondaga County?
Well, Linda, back in 2008, there were three known cases of syphilis in Onondaga County. In 2014, we had 56 cases that were diagnosed.
I'd say that's quite a rise.
That is a significant epidemic.
How do you know if you have syphilis? I mean, what does syphilis look like? What does it feel like? How would someone know if they had it?
Typical signs are painless ulcers in your mouth, on your genitals, or along the anal area, a rash. And typically, a telltale sign of syphilis is rash on your palms or the soles of your feet, but it's not always there. So if you do have a diffuse rash throughout your body, you may want to be considered for testing, as well as unusual hair loss and maybe some onset of hearing changes, maybe some eye changes, maybe some eye infections that could be a sign of syphilis.
So any of those things to be on the lookout for. But isn't it true that in many cases syphilis has no symptoms, or somebody can be totally unaware they may have it?
That is correct. It's not like you have a vaginal discharge, or you do not have to have an ulcer along your genitals or in the mouth. Many times you do not realize you have the symptoms.
And basically it just occurs as a result of having sexual relationships with someone who has the disease.
That is correct.
And there's no other way to really know that if someone doesn't know they have it.
So and that is correct.
Wow. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with certified nurse midwife Heather Shannon. We're trying to talk about STDs and get a handle on all this increased incidence. Why is this so worrisome? What are the effects of syphilis in particular, but STDs? What can it do? What are the consequences?
Well, STDs are really broad, and they do have some serious consequences if you have one, whether it's syphilis or any of the other ones that are out there, especially for women dealing with reproduction. So infertility could be a problem. Scar tissue could be developed, which could cause the difficulty with getting pregnant or achieving a full-term pregnancy. In terms of syphilis, there's some neurological issues that can occur, and eventually you could die from syphilis.
So syphilis, I mean, generations and generations ago was the kind of thing that went untreated, unknown about, and people ended up basically even becoming mentally unbalanced.
Correct.
And having severe neurological symptoms and dying from it.
That's right. That's right.
So basically, syphilis right now is the one that's on the rise, but are we having problems with these other STDs? Let's talk about what some of the others are that are of concern.
The other STDs that are concerning are the gonorrhea and chlamydia, as well as HPV. But gonorrhea and chlamydia, typically you do have symptoms, whether it's a vaginal discharge or an odor, or men may have a discharge from their penis in certain cases. So if you feel that there is something unusual or you don't feel right in your genital area, you need to be evaluated.
Let's talk a little bit about what each of them are, because I don't think people really understand it. So chlamydia is a bacterial infection, so it's sexually transmitted.
That's correct.
And it affects what parts of the body, specifically the urethra?
The urethra, the vaginal canal, the uterus, and it can also go up into the tubes for women. And in terms of men, it can occur within the urethra.
I read somewhere that the eyes can be affected as well.
Definitely. With childbirth, and that's why it's very important in pregnancy for women to be tested for gonorrhea and chlamydia, because a chlamydial infection as well as gonorrheal infection could be very dangerous to the baby, whether it's sepsis or whether it's an eye infection that can cause blindness.
Passing through the birth canal,
that's correct, when they deliver.
Mm-hmm. And usually, how would you know if you have chlamydia, and what does that feel like?
So it's usually just symptoms of vaginal discharge with possibly an odor, an abnormal foul-smelling odor. But not all women have those symptoms. So there's women who may have one or any of these infections and not know it. And that's why it's very important for women to go for their annual GYN screening. It's typical and it's recommended by the CDC for any woman under the age of 30 to have cultures for gonorrhea, chlamydia at their annual screenings with their pap smear and co-testing for HPV. That's very important because many of us do not always carry symptoms of these STDs.
Let's go on to gonorrhea. I want to talk about each of them, and then I want to talk again a little bit more about what are the recommended screenings that each person should have, whether they be male, female, and what have you. But what exactly is gonorrhea? I mean, it's often been called the clap. I mean, I've heard that kind of, thrown around, but it's sexually transmitted. It's also an infection. Is it also bacterial?
It is bacterial.
Okay. What does it affect? What parts of the body?
As with chlamydia, it affects the genitals. So you deal with the vagina, the uterus, the cervix, and as well as the fallopian tubes, which leads to pelvic inflammatory disease in women. For the men, it's also the urethra as well.
So, and the kind of symptoms, again, is burning, some kind of a foul-smelling discharge, what have you. And if you have any of those, you don't always have symptoms, but if you have any of those symptoms, you should really be checked out.
That's correct.
But let's get to treatment now. So if you have any of those things, these things like syphilis, chlamydia, or gonorrhea, what is the treatment?
It's typically an antibiotic, depending on the particular bacteria that we're dealing with, whether it's gonorrhea or chlamydia or the syphilis, antibiotics is the primary choice recommended by the CDC. Some are in injection form, some are in oral form. Very rarely for a bacterial infection, which is not typically considered sexually transmitted, there is vaginal forms as well.
And how effective are the antibiotics in curing these diseases?
They are very effective as long as you are taking the full dose as recommended.
And do you have to repeat that? In other words, is it the kind of thing where you can be reinfected?
You can be reinfected. It's very important that when you are diagnosed with a sexually transmitted disease that you notify your partners so they could be treated as well. That helps decrease the transmission to other people. Besides being treated with you and your partner, you do need to refrain from intercourse until you've completed your course of treatment, as well as come back into the office for a follow-up culture to make sure that you are cured.
Right. Let's get to HPV. I don't want to get into great detail about it, but there's been a lot of controversy about it. That's human papillomavirus. And that can lead to what in people?
It can lead to cervical cancer in women. It can lead to genital warts in both men and women. And it can also lead to anal cancer. It can lead to oral cancer, throat cancer, both in men and women.
And that basically is also, it's sexually transmitted.
Correct.
And we don't have, but it's a virus. It is not a bacteria, so we don't treat it with antibiotics. So let's discuss very briefly, what do we do with it?
So with HPV virus for women, it's very important that you go in for your annual GYN exam and get your co-testing, which is now your pap smear and HPV testing. That is the only way we could diagnose whether you have positive HPV or not. So it's very important. And there's specific guidelines in terms of your age, as well as your past history of cervical cancer or cervical disease related to HPV, in terms of how often you need to come in for your co-testing. But it's very important at a young age, you do come in for your annual exams, and we recommend coming in at the age of 21 for your first pap smear and HPV test.
But we're also talking now about the vaccine. Tell us a little bit about that and why it's been so controversial.
So there's an HPV vaccine out there. There's two types that are available. I won't name the name brands, but there are two types. One of them deals with the warts, the two most common wart HPVs, as well as the two most common cervical cancer causing HPV viruses. The other vaccine only deals with the two types of cervical cancer HPV, so you lose a protective benefits for a potential wart, low-risk HPV.
But what's the recommendation in terms of what age and who should be getting this vaccine?
So it's common that at the age of 9, both girls and boys are offered the HPV vaccine. I would say by the age of 11, hopefully they have received their first vaccination, and it's a series of 3 vaccines over a 6-month period.
And the thinking there is that if you do it before an individual becomes sexually active, they can be protected from basically getting this virus.
So with the HPV virus, and that's correct, Linda, with the HPV virus, there are over 40 strains that are out there. And unfortunately, this Gardasil HPV vaccine only deals with the two most common that causes cervical cancer. So yes, you are protected from those two types. However, you have 38 others that you could be exposed to during your sexual history. But we know that these are the ones that are the most high risk for developing cervical cancer. So it is worthwhile to having your child vaccine.
So just very briefly, in the little bit of time we have left, what are the recommendations for screenings for all of these types of STDs, first screenings for men and women? When should you be screened? Who should be screened?
At any age, if you have any symptoms that you're experiencing, you need to come in and be evaluated. If you don't have any symptoms, you at least need to be evaluated on an annual basis, which is once a year. HIV is very important to be tested, as well as syphilis, which are both blood tests. So I would highly recommend when you go to your provider to ask for these tests. It's not always offered.
Specifically, though, are gay and bisexual men encouraged to be screened at least once a year at this point, given the fact that syphilis is now on the rise among that population?
Definitely at least once a year. If they are in a higher risk population, then it may be more frequently, which could be every 3 to 6 months.
And how about women in general, if you're pregnant? What should you be screened for?
You do need to be tested as soon as you come in for your first prenatal visit. You will have the blood test for HIV and syphilis, as well as the vaginal cultures for the gonorrhea and chlamydia. And every pregnant woman does need to be screened, and periodically throughout the remainder of the pregnancy.
And one last piece. If you find that you have any of these, you really need to notify any of your sexual partners of this.
Any and all.
Very, very good. Thanks so much. My guest has been Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and director of Upstate's Midwifery and Gynecology Program. Coming up next, the Affordable Care Act's impact on primary care. What are its unmet promises? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Whether it's a family physician, an internist, a pediatrician, or a nurse practitioner, primary care providers are often the first contact that we have with the healthcare system and our first line of defense in protecting our health. But how has the Affordable Care Act under President Obama affected primary care? What promises were made and what still remain? Here to shed light on all of this is Dr. Jim Greenwald, professor of family medicine and the director of the Rural Medical Scholars Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Greenwald.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in. So let's start out by fleshing out the role of primary care in this country. What exactly do they do for us?
A primary care physician is the first contact for a patient in the healthcare system. So if you have got symptoms and you don't know what those symptoms involve, you go to your primary care physician. About 90% of the time, maybe 95% of the time, your primary care physician is going to be able to help you deal with those symptoms, or if they discover something through a screening exam, help you treat that condition. 5 to 10% of the time, you might end up going to a specialist. So that's the way it should work. And when people have a long-term relationship with a primary care physician, there's lots of evidence that this is a really good thing.
Yeah, what do they do in terms of preventive care? Because that's also very important. I mean, we have acute care issues. Obviously, you have a high fever, or you fallen and twisted your ankle or something. Excuse me. But in terms of preventive care?
The preventive care has changed over the years. It used to be that everybody would have a physical at a certain interval. For newborns, it's maybe every few weeks. For the elderly, it's at least once a year, sometimes more often. Things have changed a little bit in that the physical exam is perhaps the least important part of the preventive visit, and a lot of it has to do with sitting down and talking with people, perhaps doing a few tests that have been proven to have a good outcome, whether they're mammograms or give them some shots, if they're needed.
Like vaccinations, for example.
Vaccinations. But things have changed over the years in that a lot of physicians are working that kind of stuff into routine visits that patients might be having for other reasons. So prevention is an important part of what we do, and there's good evidence that looking for certain chronic conditions at all ages, can be very helpful. And, your family doctor, your other primary care physicians always have a good idea what's needed for people who are at normal risk and what people might be at high risk for,
like
other conditions.
Measuring your cholesterol, giving you, helping you with dietary concerns. If you're a diabetic, helping you, doing some counseling in that regard. Yeah. Those kinds of things. Flu shots.
You
overall.
Bet.
What happens to people then when they don't have access to good primary care, though?
When people don't have access to primary care, their conditions often go to a point where they are much more serious, where they're even disabling. And so instead of coming in with just a little high blood pressure, they might come in with a stroke, or they might come in with kidney failure. And so studies show that people who don't have primary care in general don't live as long, and they're sicker in the amount of time that they do survive.
And also they might end up in an emergency room and admitted to a hospital with obviously the notion of our concern for healthcare costs, that becomes exponential in terms of the cost.
Absolutely.
The cost to the system.
Cost to the system, and in some ways the cost to the individuals go up.
There's a new concept out there called a medical home. Can you help us understand what that is?
The medical home concept was actually developed by some pediatricians, and it's been popularized. At some level, it's kind of something that puts into words and puts into concrete practices what happens to a small town country doc where everybody knows everybody and people try to do their best to make sure that people's healthcare needs. So instead of just going to the doctor when you're sick or going for regular checkups, there's more to it with a medical home, that we try to link up in a powerful way with community services to make sure that the flow of communication is good, that we actually go out and hunt down people if they're not taking care of their healthcare needs. So if you've got somebody who's a diabetic and they're poorly controlled and they haven't been in for a visit or they haven't been in for their screening tests, and most practices are now starting to do this. We have nurses or we have people that we hire who call folks up on the phone and say, hey, it's time to do this.
To really make sure that they don't go over the deep, into the deep end.
That's right. That's
basically
right.
To stay on top of their care and help people recognize what the warning signs and all of that are as well.
Absolutely.
They're trying to make a change in order to, and this is part of Obamacare, but it's been something that's been talked about for probably the last 20 years, is the idea of trying to bend the cost curve in the sense that healthcare is just exponentiating every year in terms of the cost to all of us. So they're trying to change, the health insurers are trying to change the way that they pay from a fee for service to a quality measure type of outcome-based care. How do you see this working?
At some level, it's begun already. And in general, organized medicine is in favor of this model. So, for example, because our practice is a patient-centered medical home at the highest level available, we get a little bonus from Medicaid, or, we could choose to get a bonus from some other insurance care, from Medicare, for example, if we had more elderly people, but we've got a lot of kids and young families in our practice.
So there are some savings by your being aggressive in your care, in a sense, and then the incentive to you to do that is that you get some of that savings.
Absolutely.
You get some of those savings.
And so as time goes on, we're going to see more and more of payments coming to the system, and that the different roles that need to be done in the system, whether they need to be done by primary care physicians or whether they need to be done by community health workers or whether the care needs to be done by specialists, that we'll get incentives for keeping track of populations and for good outcomes, that our population has lower costs and better healthcare indices.
As opposed to doing more and more tests and various procedures just for the sake of being able to generate billing.
Yeah, the current system is called fee-for-service, and we get paid for seeing somebody. We get paid a lot more often for doing procedures than for talking to somebody or teaching them about their health care or trying to decide what the cause of a problem is. And the idea behind this population basis or bundled payments is that we'll be spending the money on the things that we ought to be spending it on and not getting any incentive for just doing stuff
that are maybe unnecessary.
That might be unnecessary.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with family practitioner Dr. Jim Greenwald. We're talking about healthcare reform and the fate of primary care. So what has Obamacare done to primary care? I mean, we've touched on some of these things, but has it made it better? Are we now paying for cognitive, for the stuff that the primary care doctor is doing in terms of counseling and talking to the patient, and not only being paid for the things they actually do, procedures, that kind of stuff? Is that happening?
Yeah, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010 was a start, and we've certainly seen some good things. We see more patients in our practices who didn't have health insurance and now have health insurance. And, you know, like I say, we've gotten some of these incentive payments for doing things to go out and you know, make a medical home to help patients keep track of their problems in a more powerful way. Some of the whole overall goal of this was to get access for everybody for good health care in America, and also to cut down on the wasteful spending. We know that we spend a lot more for medicine in this country than people do in other comparable countries. And in spite of that, we don't have as good healthcare indices. So we wanted to reduce spending, make healthcare safer, make it more effective. And there's a general thought that there needs to be more primary care physicians, especially primary care physicians for people who are thought to be underserved, either in poor communities, in urban areas, and especially in rural communities.
So is that happening? And how has Obamacare had an impact on that?
You know, it's happening in little ways. There certainly are not a whole lot more primary care physicians, but there have been little, state by state, there have been little experimental programs which have started and improved health cares for populations, such as, you know, there's, you know, little projects all over the country. If you look at the Obamacare website, it talks about, you know, Medicare patients in Pennsylvania and Medicaid patients in Texas, and how little things have been done in those areas to make the health of those populations. But in terms of the overall United States, there's still a lot of people who aren't served well, and some of the initial changes in insurance haven't necessarily made it easier for people to get all the care that they actually need.
So in some sense, there have been promises made, as you've said, and as of yet, some of are basically unmet, you know, in terms of really meeting the needs of access for all.
I think a lot more could be done, and at this point, a lot of what has been done has in some ways made it more stressful on the few primary care physicians that we've got around the country.
In what way? In the little bit of time we have left, how has it made it more stressful?
More paperwork, more you know, justifying little expenses that we're doing for our patients, less time face-to-face with the patients.
More pressure to see more people?
There's certainly pressure to see, to do more in the time that we see patients, absolutely. And, you know, there just aren't people to replace us. There's some people who think that as many as two out of every three family physicians, you know, are thinking of retiring in the next few years. We're getting older, the primary care physicians, and we're not seeing people coming in to replace us.
Do you think this change of payments is going to, or the way that they basically healthcare is being paid for, will incent people to go into primary care, or the opposite, will drive them back into specialty areas?
I think in the long run, I think it's going to be a struggle for the next 10 years in many different ways. And I don't think family doctors are necessarily going to make a whole lot more money. I do think that perhaps the specialists are going to make quite a bit less.
So somehow, the hope is that it will balance out?
Yes.
Well, I hope you're right. I know we're in a transition, a large transition in healthcare, and I guess unless you had a crystal ball, it's pretty hard to see exactly how it's going to all turn out. But thank you for coming in and sharing your perspective with us. My guest has been Dr. Jim Greenwald, Professor of Family Medicine and the Director of the Rural Medical Scholars Program at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Learning from my broken bones, or compassion, the healing feeling. Well, folks, running and biking are how I care for my mind and body. They keep me strong and balanced, at least I think so. So it was painfully discombobulating when my running feet some black ice on asphalt, and gravity combined to lead one of my ribs to complain vociferously or voriberously, crack. Now, I'd heard a broken rib is painful, but I found levels I didn't know existed, whimpering, please, please, please stop pain. But as my rib went from whimper to wince to almost better, I also found gratitude and sheer awe for how our bodies heal. And I found heartwarming appreciation for little caring gestures like, oh, can I help with your coat, or carry that for you, or how's your rib? Including appreciation to me for the tender touch of my own patience and gentleness. Everybody's compassion made that rib feel better. Then, to celebrate healthy again, my wife Pammy and I headed to sunny Florida, with me on lovely long bike rides, tootling along joyfully until, yowie, the handlebars came off. Yeah, who knew? I flew over where the handlebars used to be until so very recently, and kaboom, my wisely helmeted head on the asphalt, followed quickly and no doubt gracefully by the rest of me, broke the fall with my left hand still clamped on those handlebars. Wobbly, woozy getting up, but really glad not to break my neck. I did, quoting official orthopedic doc lingo here, smash, end quote, my ring finger metacarpal bone. Now, if anybody's listening, I don't need more convincing that broken bones hurt. I've got that down. What's surprising again, though, is how healing compassion and caring feel. Oh, what happened to your hand? Do you need help with that? Hope your hand feels better soon. With the best so far, our friend Margie sending a scrumptious piece of chocolate cake with get well soon, Richie, while funny man Peter told wife Pammy to lock me in a closet. I like that one, Peter. In sum, these little misadventures find me developing bone-deep determination when sometimes pain just comes our way to bring compassion and caring along for the ride back to healthy. I'm Dr. Rich, behind Overbean O'Neill. Thanks for your kindness and for tuning in, everybody.
Next up, the dangers of powdered caffeine. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of June 7th. Believe in your buds. We all had that one vegetable we refused to eat as a child, but times and taste buds change. Don't let that past prevent you from getting the nutritional benefits of asparagus, lima beans, peas, Brussels sprouts, or your personal veggie villain. Our flavor profiles vary greatly with age. You may just find a new favorite in your former foe. Embrace your adulthood this week by trying a vegetable that you wouldn't have touched as a child. Start slowly by adding it to a favorite dish. And if it's still not love at first bite, congratulate yourself for at least giving it a try. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. For most adults and adolescents in the U.S., caffeine is part of everyday life. And while we tend to associate caffeine with certain beverages, it's also commonly found in many of our foods and medicines as well. But most of us don't think of caffeine as a drug, and certainly not a dangerous one. Until now. Meet powdered caffeine.
Joining us with more on this is Dr. William Eggleston. He's a pharmacist and fellow in clinical toxicology at Upstate Medical University and with the Upstate New York Poison Center. Welcome, Dr. Eggleston.
Thanks for coming in.
So caffeine now comes in powdered form. What is it? Tell me, explain that.
So caffeine's always existed in powdered form. It's brought in bulk from various different countries, and typically it's used by the soft drink industry, by the coffee industry, as a supplement to their beverages. But recently it's become available direct to consumer. So I can go online and I can buy the same pure caffeine powder that places like Coke and Pepsi have been using to add to their beverages for years and years.
So what's the problem with this? Why is it a problem?
So this is 100% pure caffeine. It's not something that's diluted. It's not something that's mixed. It's straight caffeine. And so we typically think of caffeine as being something part of our everyday lives. It's something we use to get up in the morning. It's something we take maybe in a medicine when we have a headache. But this is because this is such a high amount in a small volume, you can get into trouble pretty quickly if you misuse it.
I read somewhere that 1 teaspoon of this powdered caffeine is as powerful as drinking 25 cups of caffeinated coffee.
Yeah, that's correct. 1 teaspoon is about 25 cups. And if you go online, you know, it's available in various sizes. And depending on how much you buy, you get your price. So I looked this morning and I can get a 100-gram bag for about $5 to $10 at the moment.
Wow.
And that bag is equivalent to about 560 medium-sized Dunkin' Donuts coffees.
Wow.
So for $9, I can have my caffeine for over a year.
My goodness. That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
So help us, remind us right now, what caffeine actually does to the body.
Absolutely. So caffeine is kind of like if you think about when a car goes and you hit on the gas and the car takes off. But then if you're going too fast, you can hit on the brakes and slow down. Our body has the same type of system. We have stimulant chemicals like norepinephrine, to get technical. And then when you have too much of that, your body has another chemical called adenosine that's the brake. It comes in and says, "Whoa, we're going too fast, let's slow down." And so what caffeine does is it gets in the way. It stops that adenosine. It takes away the brake. So your body gets an overdrive of stimulatory chemicals without its normal way to stop them.
Wow. What are some of the symptoms? In other words, increased heart rate, sometimes an uneven heart rhythm. What are the kinds of things that it does? What do you experience?
So it's a bit of a spectrum. If you think about maybe you haven't had coffee for a week and now this morning you've got a big test, so you drink 3 cups and you might feel a little sick to your stomach and maybe your hands are shaking a little bit. And that's kind of the low end of what it does. And as you move forward and you push up the doses, your heart rate increases. And as your heart rate increases, you can have abnormal heartbeats, which is what we call arrhythmias, that can lead to fatalities. And then you can also have, because it penetrates the brain so well, toxicity up there from all the stimulation. So you can see things like seizures, hallucinations, agitation. So with, tremor and nausea and vomiting being kind of on the low end, and as you push forward, arrhythmias and seizures on the high end.
And clearly things like difficulty sleeping, sometimes even tremors that go along
Absolutely,
with that.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's withdrawal associated with it as well. So caffeine, when you use too much of it, can definitely be a detrimental thing.
So is it addictive? Addictive?
It can be, yes. If you think about when you don't have your morning coffee, if you drink it every day, there is an actual withdrawal associated with caffeine. So you might get a little bit irritable. You might get a little bit agitated, maybe a little shaky, a headache, and then you take your coffee and you feel better. So caffeine in and of itself can be addictive.
It's so interesting because, as you said earlier, most of us think about using caffeine in a fairly kind of benign way. I mean, we all grow up knowing that if you drink coffee, you seem more alert kind of thing. Or as you said, you might take it in a medicine like an Excedrin or something of that nature because
exactly.
You have a headache.
It's very ubiquitous, which is what makes this drug so scary. So caffeine is probably one of the most unique supplements in the entire country because it exists as a supplement in powder form, in tablet form that you can buy as a health supplement. It exists as a food within soda and coffee. And so there's different bodies that regulate those two areas. And then it also exists in drug form. So it exists in things like Nodos and Excedrin as over-the-counter drugs. And then it's a prescription drug as well that we use in the hospital. So it runs the gamut from supplement all the way down to regulated medicine. But there's no one body that governs all of those.
So the FDA really, at this point, doesn't have any control over this current offering.
Correct. Because it is marketed as a supplement, the FDA does not have the authority to step in and just say, we're going to pull this from the shelves. It's dangerous.
What's interesting to me, though, is I had never known that it was being produced as a powdered form in such large quantity. And what you helped me understand now is that it's been used for many, many, many years as the way to inject it into or add it into those beverages that we are common everyday Coke and Pepsi.
Exactly. It's very, very cheap when you buy it in bulk. And so it's always existed in that market. But in recent years, it's become direct to consumer. And now we're running into some of these issues with folks dosing their own pure caffeine.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pharmacist William Eggleston. And from the Upstate New York Poison Center, we're talking about the dangers of powdered caffeine. So I guess my biggest concern here is what actual dangers? You mentioned that if you have too much, you can go, it's kind of like a, there's a spectrum of symptoms. What happens with a true overdose with caffeine?
So in true overdose, you know, it's tough to say when you're going to start to see things like vomiting, like seizures, like arrhythmias, because you know, like any other drug, there's tolerance. So if you drink 3 cups of coffee a day, and then you've got a friend that never touches the stuff, and all of a sudden your friend uses the powder, they're going to be more sensitive. But we do know what a lethal dose is. We know that a lethal dose for your average American female or 150-pound female is about 3.5 teaspoons, which is right around 10,000 milligrams. And then your average American male, who's about 180 pounds, it's going to take them about 12,000 milligrams or 4 teaspoons of this powder. And those doses we know to be lethal.
And lethal leading to something like an arrhythmia and therefore a heart. And there have been...
Correct. Yeah, they'll either have an arrhythmia or a seizure, and there have been deaths. There was a death in Ohio back last summer, an 18-year-old high school student, and then there was another male in his 20s down in Georgia. And both of them, just based on speaking with family members and friends, it was determined that they weren't abusing it. They were trying to be health conscious. And they said, you know, if I put my caffeine in my water, it's better for me than my Mountain Dew.
Wow.
And so it was just accidental misuse that led to death.
And that's what the scary part is, as you mentioned, because it sounds to me like little differences in this powdered material can move you from a safe dose to an unsafe dose.
Absolutely. Someone who is unfamiliar with properly dosing caffeine and who maybe hasn't read the literature would maybe dose it just like their protein powder. So a lot of kids using this are using it for weightlifting and enhancement from that area. And so if you use a scoop of protein powder, why not use a scoop of caffeine
too?
Wow,
that's frightening.
As we talked about earlier, just a tablespoon is really enough to kill your average size adult.
Wow. So when did this start becoming available? I mean, you said there was a death last summer, so when did this all start to happen, to be, you know, made available to the everyday person?
So it looks like, you know, it came on the market sometime late 2013, early 2014, but no one really heard about it, as with most, you know, dangerous supplements, until there was a death. And once there was a death, we all became acutely aware of it. And there's been many advocacy groups, you know, the American Association of Poison Centers, as well as the Council for Responsible Nutrition, who is a trade group with a lot of the supplement organizations, and they have urge their members to not market these products.
So what can really be done? I mean, let's start from a legislative mm-hmm. perspective or from a legal perspective. What can they do? I mean, the FDA has no jurisdiction here?
As of right now, the FDA has not been able to step in and do anything on a national level. They are continuing to advise against use. They're considering all of their legal options, but as of yet, they have not been able to come in and say this product is not, you know, able to be sold. A couple of senators from Connecticut and Ohio have petitioned the FDA back in the late winter to remove the products, but nothing has come of that as of yet. There are local legislators. Suffolk County has prohibited sales of minors.
Oh, they have?
Yes. And okay. There are a few states. Ohio introduced a bill to ban powdered caffeine, as well as there's legislation in process in New York and New Jersey. So there are states that are taking action on their local and state levels to try and regulate the product.
But if it's being bought through the internet, how do they play any role, it
exactly.
seems to me.
I mean, that's where it gets difficult. So they can take it off the shelves and you know, not be able to have
walk into a
some
store
of the access
somewhere
that they would have before. Exactly. So you can't walk down to a corner store and buy it. But like you said, you could still go online and buy it all you want. And so that makes it very difficult from a legislative perspective.
I mean, is there the thought that, I mean, is there any hope that there will be, based on these legislative initiatives, that there will be a larger scale effort or even a federal effort to actually ban them?
So from what we can tell now, folks familiar with the FDA and their processes say that they don't anticipate any sweeping legislation in the next year to pull these products from the shelves. It's very muddy water, because then where do you come through and say, you know, your coffee can only contain this much and your soda can only contain this much. So regulation of caffeine is a tricky thing because it is so ubiquitous in our society.
Are there other drugs that fit that, you know, profile? It strikes me as that's a very, very unique set of circumstances.
To my knowledge, there are no other drugs to fit that profile that are regulated in such murky ways. You know, we have it on, as I had said, a prescription drug level, an over-the-counter drug level, a food level, and then a supplement level. So all different regulations apply to each one of those different areas.
So it's going to take a unique set of legislation or a unique act somehow to change this. And it would be sad to think that we'd have to lose more young people as a result of that.
Absolutely. It's going to take, you know, some very clever legislation to remove these products from the shelves.
Well, in lieu of that, in place of that, I mean, what can people do? I mean, what do you recommend, or what are, as part of the New York State Poison Control, I mean, New York Upstate Poison Control, what do you recommend people do?
So
parents, concerned adults, what have you?
You know, I think this needs to be a conversation that's had between parents and their children and amongst friends. And these are products where we really cannot, we're in line with the FDA. You know, you can't advocate these use. They should not be available direct to consumer. You need a lab grade scale, you know, one of those scales you used back in chemistry, in order to accurately dose these products.
And so a kitchen teaspoon, for example,
will
even
never be able to accurately dose these products. The advised dose is about a 16th of a teaspoon. So I would challenge someone to go home and try and measure out a 16th of a teaspoon and see how close you get. And it's not something that's easily done.
So basically what you're advocating is for parents or concerned adults, if they sense that this is happening in their environment, to put a stop to it.
I would say so, yes. You know, the big concern is there's always going to be people who want to misuse substances. And that's the reality of what we deal with. But it's not that. That's not the major concern here. The major concern is accidental misuse. You know, things like no-dose tablets that are caffeine tablets. You have to take 16 of those to equal about a teaspoon of this powder. So someone's not going to accidentally take 16 tablets, but someone may accidentally take a teaspoon of powder.
Well, it's very, very, very frightening. So clearly people, parents, concerned adults, and unfortunately it's young adults who become most involved in this kind of thing because they do.
Yes, yeah.
We know this from every other type of drug.
I mean, it's the
that
perfect
there is.
Market. It's marketed to health conscious, athletic individuals who are burning the candle at both ends.
And what happens if you believe that you're having some kind of a caffeine overdose? What do you recommend? I mean, what's the important thing to know?
So, Kev, especially with these powders, you can see toxic effects in as little as 30 minutes. So if you think that you have misused or misdosed this, you know, I would advise seeking medical attention through emergency resources immediately and getting to a hospital to be evaluated. In the interim, if there's folks who have questions about these, they can always contact the New York Poison Center, the Upstate
or
New York
other poison
center.
Centers.
Yes,
right.
Or any poison center at 1-800-222-1222.
Very good.
And they'll be happy to help with any
questions.
Well,
thank you so much. I really appreciate your coming in. This is very important information for people to know about. And it's a very scary thing. I mean, you could almost sprinkle it on your food inadvertently, have no idea of the amount, and really put yourself at risk.
Absolutely.
My guest has been Dr. William Eggleston. He's a pharmacist and fellow in clinical toxicology at Upstate Medical University. And he's with the Upstate New York Poison Center as well. Thanks so much for coming in.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Carnivals and circuses are poets' delights, so many metaphors and symbols parading before them. Here are two poets who use those settings to two very different effects. First is Heather Palmer, a student at the University of Wisconsin in La Crosse. Her poem is called "That's When I Left the Circus." Growing up, I felt like I lived in a circus, but the circus had no ringmaster. Instead, every act would happen at once, gymnasts flipping past knife throwers, jugglers dodging lions, cannons exploding from every angle. My mother's personalities would spill out at random, like an endless stream of clowns emerging from a tiny car. I felt like a tightrope walker, scared to breathe, scared to blink. Shaking with each step, I'd make it halfway across when someone would shake the rope. But every time I fell, there was a net of people waiting to catch me, and I realized I could feed the lions something else besides me. The second poem comes from pediatrician Sarah Quayle, whose poetry is often inspired by her work with the children and families she ministers to. Here is her poem, "The Carnival Mirror." The world is a carnival of food, a carousel of choices, a pageant of invisible calories, every day a sickening roller coaster of eating and fasting. I'm told I must eat to live, but I cannot manage these mealy mouthfuls. A single morsel sticks in my throat, bloats my stomach, adds ugly rolls of flabby flesh to my belly and thighs. They say that I am thin, that people can practically see through me. They don't see the girl behind this mask, performing for a crowd of slender strangers, don't know how I juggle and count and plan. They tell me the carnival mirror distorts, that the fat lady is thin. But I know the truth behind the glass, and I am still afraid.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the continuing dangers of lead exposure for our kids, plus the powerful consequences of stroke and how group support can help, and an historical perspective on running Upstate University Hospital. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.